On January 2, 2023, Buffalo Bills safety DeMar Hamlin collapsed due to cardiac arrest during an NFL game. Since then, there has been so much discussion on social media. It has been pointed out that the paramedics who transported DeMar off the field had the most important job, the job of keeping DeMar alive en route to the hospital, and that they are almost certainly the lowest paid people of anyone on the football field that day. In honor of our hardworking EMTs and paramedics, this episode is about pre-hospital care. And to do this, we have a very special guest, Mike Linares from SimpleNursing.com. By the end of this episode, you will have a better understanding of what happens to your patients before they arrive to the hospital and why this is crucial for nurses to know. We'll also talk about what care can be delivered on scene and en route, as well as the many limitations when providing care on an ambulance rig. If you've always wanted to ride along in an ambulance but never had the chance, keep on listening for a glimpse into the Wild West of pre-hospital care. Welcome to the Up My Nursing Game podcast. My name is Annie. I've been a clinical nurse for 8 years, and I am curious. I use this podcast to address common clinical questions, share unique perspectives across the healthcare team, and cover what's missed in nursing school. As you may have noticed, I've opted for shorter, more punchier episodes lately, for which I am unfortunately unable to give CE credits. I will continue to offer CEs for longer episodes, such as the one you're about to listen to. Let's jump into the interview. Have you ever considered taking the CCRN, PCCN, or CMC exams? Passing the PCCN opened up a lot of doors for me, including a job offer to a higher acuity floor and points towards the next step on the clinical nurse ladder. I studied for the PCCN using Nicole Kupchick's online review courses and book of practice questions. Check out all of her study materials at NicoleKupchickConsulting.com and use the promo code UPMYGAME20 to get 20% off all of her products. All right. So today we have Mike Linares. He is, if you've been living under a rock, the founder of SimpleNursing.com, which is essentially the Netflix for nursing students. I'm sure you've seen his face floating around on YouTube if you've searched about anything related to nursing. And I'm so excited to have you on today.
Thank you so much. I am excited to be here.
Mike, tell us a little bit about your journey and about Simple Nursing as it stands today.
Oh man, there's so much to talk about. I started in the medical field at 18 years old. I was actually going through my EMT program still in high school, the last semester of high school at 17. So honestly, EMT school, or really the first time you do anything medical, it's the most difficult thing in the world. I still remember EMT school being like the most difficult thing for me, maybe just because I was young. But when you become an EMT, you don't have any anatomy, physiology, no micro, no chemistry. You're just literally dropped into like a 6-month course. And it's like, oh crap. You have to learn everything about the heart flow and all the things at the same time. But after that, I started working on an ambulance, mostly doing like interfacility transports, like dialysis stuff. So in my mind, my 18-year-old mind, I thought like, oh, nurses don't really do much. They just work in a nursing home or they work at a dialysis center, right? I just really didn't understand how nurses worked. And I was actually talking people out of becoming nurses because I just didn't understand at the time. It wasn't until I started working in the ER, and I really got to start working around a lot of other nurses. And I'm like, wow, nurses do everything. You can be a travel nurse. You can literally work in 80% of the hospital because 80% of the hospital staff is nurses. And I'm like, man, you can do so much with this. So long story short, I make it to third semester of nursing. I have this bad rap. And then my dean, she's really cool. She sits me down and she's like, hey, I know you can teach these courses. I know you can pass. You just need to like go through the loops, act like it's boot camp, and just get out of my hair. Just graduate. And I know you're going to be fine. You have to show me you're serious. So you have to do a project to show me you're serious. I'm like, okay, fine. And she's like, you have to think of a project. Come back to me in 2 or 3 weeks. I used to do boot camps, right, for fitness. So I'm like, what if I did like a 2-week or 14-day workshop boot camp to show nursing students how to time manage, how to think critically, how to do test taking strategies, and even some memory tricks that I personally use. And it was during that workshop, people were like, dude, put this on YouTube. So then I dedicated every Friday to doing 10 hours of videos. And so the videos you watched was literally me on a note card telling you how I'm studying for the next exam that I have. So I was end up able to pump out about 100 videos a month. And by the time I graduated, we had almost 1,000 videos.
I'm excited to talk to you today about pre-hospital care. Because my only experience with this as a nurse is just getting like a quick 2-minute report from a paramedic or EMT who's dropping off a patient emergency, or giving EMT a report who's going to take a patient, you know, transport them to whatever facility they're going to go to. So I'm excited to talk to you today about, you know, getting a better understanding of what happens to patients before they even reach the hospital and with pre-hospital care.
Yeah. So the pre-hospital setting is like the Wild West, which I try to tell nurses, even critical care nurses, because the weirdest thing about transferring or working in the ER from the ambulance is like the ER is like a cruise ship, right? It's, you have so much resources. You have so much, like, you know, you have a doctor right there. You have RT you can call. You have a CAT scan. You have so much staff and even people that can help you. But when you're in the ambulance by yourself, all alone, you're just literally one person on one patient, and you're literally between them and life and death. So it's pretty scary. I can tell you numerous times where, you know, it was just like, dude, you can try your best to do everything you can for this client, but you already know, like, there's nothing really you can do, especially with the equipment and ACLS drugs you have. You know, there's no ventilator. You have to bag the patient. Now, usually a firefighter will come along and help bag if they need a bag. Okay. But sometimes there was a few friends that actually had to bag and start IV and then bag and then do. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's the Wild West. No one's there to help you, really, especially if you really need to go fast. And yeah, so what usually happens is you'll call in a dispatch. They're going to route you to a hospital. Let's just say it's a heart attack. They're going to try to get you to a STEMI center or a stroke receiving center if it's a stroke. Now, it really just depends on the severity of the client. So if your client is in really bad shape, they're just going to get you to the next receiving and then ship out the patient once they're stabilized after that.
Yeah. Let's take a step back. One question that a lot of people have, myself including, was what is the difference here between an EMT, which is an emergency medical technician, and a paramedic?
The easiest way to describe this, it's the difference between an LPN or LVN and an RN. So EMTs go through about 6 months. You can even do it like in 2 weeks. You can do EMT really quick. It's basically EMT, you can't do tubes or needles or drugs. So you can basically do everything else. You can, it's basically kind of like an ER tech almost. So you can do, like, you know, chest compressions, you can do bandage, you can do splinting, you can do C-spine support, everything else. Now, paramedics is everything with, well, not everything. Intubation and drugs mainly, and IVs. It really depends on the jurisdiction and the state as well as the county, because you can do more things rather than less things. And then paramedic school is usually about a year long. I've never heard of anything less.
In my experience, the ACLS classes that I've taken have been taught by paramedics. Mm-hmm. And I'm always so impressed, like, they know their stuff.
Yeah. So my brother always has like this chip on his shoulder where he thinks he's like always better than nurses. Like, and he just says nurses as a blanket statement, like not knowing that nurses have subacute specialties everywhere else. And just like, yeah, because I can save a patient's life. He has this God complex or Superman complex. So it's like, I can do it all, you know?
Yeah. Like, I mean, they do a lot.
But I'm like, okay, like you can do a lot, but it's like, you're only doing this one specialty, right? And you can stabilize a client and you can, like, you know, save their life for 30 minutes or 45 minutes and drop them off at a facility. But you don't really even know how to manage events. You don't know, like, a lot of the things that go on in the ER. You don't know how to delegate, really, or how to manage a staff, or how to do collaborative care, or do post-op, you know.
Patient teaching.
Yeah, patient teaching. He's like, literally just get them and then drop them off.
Right.
So, right. Yeah, yeah. So we always go back and forth and always, like, nag each other about things.
So when you're talking about dispatch, first of all, like what exactly is dispatch? People are always talking about dispatch. I'm like, is this like a person in a control room? Like a NASA launch? Like what is
dispatch? It looks like that kind of. So dispatch, if you can like close your eyes and like, oh man, now I'm dating myself. Like, remember like that movie MIB or Men in Black? Mm-hmm. Or even like, I don't even know if Monsters, Inc. has something like this. But it's like a huge room with like a bunch of like NASA control panels. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're taking patient calls from 911 or even other hospital facility calls and trying to set up ambulance transports with that. Gosh. Dispatch is like the brain. It's like the lifeblood of where all the ambulance and facility, where everyone needs to go, basically. So what happens is we get a call and they'll basically give us a location with an address on a map and you have to find your patient. Then we're like, okay, there's all these codes, 1097, we're on scene, and then all these things. And then we call it in, and then we're basically telling them like, hey, this is what we're dealing with. And then they'll just route you to the nearest specialty facility hospital that they can get you. Now, sometimes you don't have to go through dispatch. If it's like a minor call, you can literally call. We had like two or three hospitals in our jurisdiction area where we know if they're going to be open or not. So we just call them directly. And that's where you see like that little control room inside ERs where like a nurse would be like kind of a modified dispatcher. They'd be like, okay, I'm receiving, and they would receive. Or they basically be saying like, no, dude, like we are maxed out or whatever the term they use nowadays. And then the really cool part too is like, you're not technically all alone. Like you can actually call in. It almost sounds like you're in Vietnam, like calling an airstrike. You can actually call in like and get a doctor on the phone that can give you orders if it's something that you don't know that's kind of like either outside your scope or something that you want to clarify on a certain algorithm for ACLS that maybe you're not familiar with or maybe some updated stuff.
Okay. Or you have like a specialty case or...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What can a paramedic do in that scenario of, you know, let's say someone's having an active heart attack? Can you kind of walk through what happens at that point?
So for any chest pain or heart attack, we do an EKG on the rig. What do they do to diagnose? Like anyone could have chest pain. You don't really know unless you have like a confirmed EKG. So, or at least a patient history of some type of angina or other MIs, right? So maybe that's what they had to rely on, like maybe their client history. And then it's just regular Mona stuff. You know, the nitro, what is it, 3 every 5 minutes one every 5 minutes for a total of 3 rounds. Mm-hmm. And then the aspirin. I remember working in a facility near Fullerton where we'd have to drop off STEMI patients all the time. Mm-hmm. And there were a few paramedics that were working with us. But usually it's just... It was pretty sick. Like those are like honestly the simplest ones because they throw them up on an EKG. The guys would be sweaty. Dude, trying to get an EKG in the back of an ambulance is almost impossible. So you'd have to like stop and before you go, like figure out if the guy's having a heart attack or not.
But do you always get a 12 lead on them or can you just do a 3?
Yeah.
12.
No, you have to get a 12.
Yeah. Because
the 12 leads are for diagnostics. And yeah, they would always have to do that. But it's weird. It was just so strange because like you're packed in this little tiny ambulance with like probably 4 dudes before the ambulance takes off.
Yeah.
And then you're shaving this guy with all their chest hairs and stuff and just sticking all these things. And the guys are usually sweaty. So everything's like falling off them, like melting ooze. And then, but I mean, it's not as scary as you think because after you can only give a certain amount of drugs, right? Like Mona, right? So you can only give, you know, your nitro and aspirin first, maybe some oxygen. Sure, you can give some morphine to decrease like some preload on the heart. And then, but at the end of the day, even if you do all that stuff, you still have to go to the hospital in as short amount of time as possible. And it's usually only like 30 minutes away or 15 minutes away. Mm-hmm. So there's only a limited amount of stuff you can do. And then man, like trying to do chest compressions in the back of a bumpy ambulance is crazy.
I had an experience once of working in an emergency where I had a patient come in by ambulance for dizziness. Mm-hmm. And they put him in the part of the emergency department that was not for critically ill patients. But when I was getting a report from the paramedic, he handed me the 12 lead and he said, it might be ST elevation.
And I looked at it and I was like, yeah, that's definitely ST elevation. What are you doing here?
You're on the urgent care side, the fast track. Like, what are you guys doing
over here? Yeah. I mean, to be fair, it wasn't quite fast track. But like we had heart monitoring there, but it kind of made me realize that there's quite a lot of responsibility in that interpretation of the 12 lead.
So much responsibility. Yeah.
And can you ever, if you're unsure of what you're seeing, can you send it to a physician to be interpreted?
Yeah. So usually you can send it over there. And I think that's where you get doctor's orders and stuff at that point in time. And it's really hard on the ambulance because you don't have troponin, right? You don't have like that diagnostic that's like, oh yeah, this is an actual MI. It could be like, you know, hyperkalemia or something like that. But at the end of the day, it's like, you can only give what you can give, right? You're only allowed like a certain, you just literally have like a toolbox or a fishing box full of meds. And you're like freaking like Dr. Quinn, medicine woman, like trying to pass out Halloween candy. And it's like, you don't really, there's nothing you can really do. It's like, okay, this guy's having a heart attack. Do you give him the three drugs you gave? Yeah. Okay. Well then get your ass over here to the ER.
Yeah. Okay.
You know,
so maybe you could, you know, give an example of a more complex case, because you're right. I mean, the STEMIs are, in my experience, very straightforward. You basically just need to get them to cath lab. So maybe, I don't know, like a shortness of breath case, like a COBD exacerbation. Oh, yeah. Like, what do you have in your toolbox for something like that besides like a nasal cannula? And you said that you can intubate, correct?
Yeah. So I personally did not intubate on the ambulance, but the thing is that you can intubate, but you don't have any ventilator settings or anything like that. You just literally have a bag, right? A bag that you're just, what's it called? BBM. Dude, it sounds really bad now that I'm really like actually thinking about it. There's not much you can do.
There's not much. Okay.
It's literally just like a little band-aid, which you can do. I mean, you can save someone's life and stabilize them. And the thing is, we would give a lot of prednisone, a lot of steroids, just to open up the lungs.
Oh, okay.
But really just intubating them and just getting the airway just completely open and just doing the best you can was the number one thing that we would always do. One of the most interesting cases are always the stroke patients. Because you're just doing like a fast assessment on them, right? And you're just trying to see like how long has this been going on. Most people don't even know. They're just like, oh, grandpa's acting funny. And it's been like 8 hours or 10 or a whole day. And you're like, oh, snaps. Like, what are we doing now? I still remember those being like the most interesting cases.
Yeah. And that's when the history is so important to get.
Oh yeah, for sure. I still remember this one case where like the wife was, she was still older, but she couldn't really tell us anything about the kind of his history or really even noticing until like she noticed that day. And it's like, crap, dude.
Yeah.
So this guy probably had like a slow brain bleed. There was even this one lady who her husband just thought she was drunk, right? And seriously, yeah. She pissed herself. I think she fell down the stairs or whatever. They got in a fight. She was this little Asian lady, and the guy was, I think, like a veteran, a white dude, veteran. Anyways, long story short, take it into the ER, and the ambulance like ends up like just dropping her off. They don't even do like any neurodeficit, or they don't really do like an in-depth assessment, because everyone just writes it off as like, oh, this person's drunk. Okay, cool. And then, dude, it was bad, man. Like, I literally remember like the EMTs like not even doing a proper patient transfer, just roll her onto the bed. And so we do like our normal CT scan, and it turns out that she had such a severe brain bleed that it pushed her brain to one side.
Oh no.
And we're like, and now everyone feels like a douche. Yeah, because I think she was drunk on blood thinners, which when you drink alcohol, it makes your blood even more thin.
Yeah. So I can see then like a lot of your, I guess this is an aspect that I kind of missed earlier, is a lot of what you're doing as a pre-hospital provider is getting patient history or getting information from bystanders or hopefully like friends, family who can speak to the medical history, medications, blah, blah, blah.
That's honestly one of the most scariest things too, is because most times you don't have a history. And most times people don't even know, or they're just going to hand you a stack of papers and it's your job to like piece together like this, what's it called? This Picasso puzzle piece. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'll find guys like homeless people that are just down and you don't even know how long they've been down or really what really happened to them. And so it's like a mystery case. I mean, which is totally different in the hospital setting, right? You're always getting a report from someone. You're always getting something, and you have the tools and resources to figure it all out with the staff. Where over there, you feel like freaking Sherlock Holmes trying to figure things out and like piece things together. I do remember working in PICO, and there was an 18-year-old who got shot 5 times. I think he was a gang member, and he was just down, and like no one knew anything. Mm. And then we just had to put him in the back. We tubed him, put an IV in him. But he was bleeding out so profusely. I think he lost like more than half his blood by the time we got to USC. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing we could really do.
But you didn't know anything else about him.
No,
you're just like, here's a young man who's
shot. We
didn't
know his age, or his name or anything. And no one, usually when gang violence happens, no one wants to say anything because then they're going to be the target next, right? Mm. So it's like no one's giving info, just like man down over here. It's like, oh, crap.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, dude.
I'm interested to hear about your experience with violence, restraints, agitation. This is something I've covered in a previous episode here, is about, you know, the dangers of using physical restraints. Also chemical, medical restraints too, benzos. What's within your scope as a paramedic for addressing like a violent or agitated patient?
Yeah. I mean, dude, we get these all the time. We usually get drunk or some type of schizoaffective disorder or like some type of psychosis. And it's usually either the mental health ones or the delirium ones who got like, you know, UTIs, the old people who got septic and are just like cussing us out left and right. Mm-hmm. So usually, okay, on the ambulance, number one is scene safety. So you have to go in. So if you're going into like a nursing home or just like a violent elderly person, then that's okay usually. But if you're going to like a domestic violence, or let's say someone had a gun or someone actually did get stabbed, or someone just really aggressive, or 50-on-50, we call it. It doesn't mean like a suicide hold. In the field, it usually means a crazy person. I know. It's totally different terms. But we usually have to wait for PD to make the scene safe. And most times than not, that person who either got stabbed or shot is probably bleeding out and then a critical condition. You're waiting for a PD to like close off the scene.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's crazy.
That's going to be hard just to kind of wait in the wings while
they started PD's doing that
doing their thing.
Yeah, I think back in the day, like probably the 80s or 70s, like they would just send in paramedics and then they would have like, you know, 2 or 3 patients or 4 patients as they would get, you know, shoot up the paramedics now. So it makes sense, right? You'll lose one person instead of 3 or 4. I know, but it is crazy. But so we get to use restraints all the time. I've used them multiple times. And usually what you'll do is you'll do a thing like this, looks like a dance move. You'll put one arm up here and one arm down there.
Okay.
And it's weird because I never learned that in the hospital. They would always use vests or have just both arms down. But since the gurney is so small, they can actually, we've seen people break the little plastic arms on the gurney because they have so much strength, but it's harder to do it like this.
Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So that's a little hack.
So so podcast listeners can't see, but Mike was putting one hand like behind his head over his head and then one down to the side.
Yeah. So one arm down, one arm up. Mm-hmm. Now we have used benzos a lot in the ambulance or before hospital setting. I don't think we've ever used Geodon or Haldol. I haven't seen it used in the pre-hospital setting for someone who's really combative. Mm-hmm. We usually just try to stabilize them as much as we can and then just drop them off and get rid of them like as fast as we can.
Okay.
But the most interesting cases are the ones that there was a guy that was an ex-gang member who was just asking for water. I still remember this. Asking for water. And he was, I think we had 2 paramedics in the back at the time. And he's like, I just need some water. Like, no, we have to get you to the hospital and get you cleared first or whatever. And we had him in restraints. But anyways, long story short, he's like, if you don't give me water right now, I'm going to. And then my partner was like, you're going to what? What are you going to do?
He's poking the bear.
And I'm like, and so he's like, listen, we're here to help you, Frankie, or whatever the guy's name was. But I remember that because usually in the hospital setting, right, you're supposed to de-escalate first with therapeutic communication, crisis mode, right?
Yes.
Remove the trigger. And then do some like, you know, pharmacology stuff. And then very last, it's restraints. In the hospital, in the pre-hospital field, the exact opposite. Like throw them restraints. It's like everything's mixed. And there's no therapeutic communication like whatsoever. Like it seems like unless there's been more training since I left the ambulance setting, it's like no one really even cared about therapy communication or de-escalating. It seemed like they did the opposite. They escalated it. And yeah, hopefully it's changed. But the interesting part is like we were able to use restraints as much as they were soft restraints. I think in LA or City Fire, they have hard restraints, those leather restraints. But we were only able to use the soft ones. And then once we actually got to the ER, then the physician would either continue it or discontinue it. So,
yeah. Okay. And what were you giving? You said benzos for medical restraint?
I only remember giving benzos. I don't ever remember giving Haldol or Geodon in the pre-hospital setting. Now, in the ER, we do it all the time for the combative psychiatric patients. Do you guys give the B-52s as well?
Yes, that can be done. That was brought up in a previous episode. I think they're steering away from that now and more towards mood stabilizers. Like Zyprexa, Lanzapine, Haldol. But I think, you know, the more we're learning about benzos, the more we're kind of steering away from them.
Oh, really?
So it's good to know that, you know, that could still be given to a patient. And quite often you get the paradoxical effect, right? Like you get the initial benefits of a benzo and then hours later, the patient's even worse. So I think that's important to keep in mind as a nurse. Yeah.
As an ambulance person, they're just like, well, it's not going to be my problem in an hour. So,
right. And it's not something that we can see like an MR that, you know, this patient got benzos. It's just something you're going to have to see like in the initial intake report is what the patient got in the ambulance.
I know my brother was saying that he's like up to date with all like the new protocols on the ambulance and stuff. But apparently they're still giving fentanyl as a pain med on the ambulance.
A lot. Yeah. Like, yeah. Wow. I mean, it makes sense to me because it's so short acting that it's fairly safe because, yeah, it's going to be exiting your system really quickly. Is there anything else you'd like to add to this discussion? Anything that, I mean, I think that, you know, the whole basis of this is like, what do nurses need to know about what happens before a patient arrives?
Oh, yeah. All right. So to wrap this up, what nurses really have to know about what happens before patients arrive is just a big show, you know, just like, it's crazy. It's a wild west. one of the most, the biggest things is, really getting a really good detailed history from the paramedics is the number one thing. Trying to get as much information as you can about what exactly happened. Now, that's usually only for critical cases, right? If you're at a trauma hospital or some type of like demi-receiving or stroke. But more times than not, people come to community hospitals or ERs just for like, you know, regular run-of-the-mill stuff. But that's really the hard part because it's going to... Some of the most interesting cases that caught us off guard was that, you know, they caught us sleeping, right? In a sense, it's like, okay, this person's just drunk. It's like, no, they actually had a stroke and a brain bleed so bad that it pushed their brain to one side. And really just almost like considering every case as like the worst possible scenario and not really writing it off until you actually figure it out. So, yeah.
That's got to be pretty hard when you're doing this all day, every day to assume the worst. Every time when so often you see like pretty minor things.
And I think that's where your nursing sixth sense comes in because that's where the veterans get. Once you have that gut feeling after you've been on the clinical setting for at least, I think at least 2 to 5 years, then you like, okay, you have that feeling and you always got to go with that feeling. Like it's usually always right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, this is really interesting. It gives me an appreciation for paramedics and, you know, how much is done like autonomously on the rig there. I know you're working from protocols, but just so much is done without like the oversight of a physician or RT there. And it sounds like it's a dangerous job too, in terms of, I mean, infection control even. You're saying you're not really using like gowns and just gloves. Not-
I don't think I've ever seen anyone use a gown when I was there. They probably do it now.
Yeah.
I mean, they do have N95 masks and things like that, but it's like, especially in the ER, it's like, how many times have you sent a patient upstairs like, oh, this person had scabies or this person had TB? Like, oh, crap.
All the time. Yeah. So I'm sure you're like really disinfecting the rig after.
Oh, man. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was just, yeah. Crazy stuff.
Well, thank you, Mike, for being on the show.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It was fun.
I wanted to share a few words here to reflect on some of what Mike talked about. What I think can come off as uninformed or even cavalier from Mike's tales from his time as an EMT uncovers a misunderstanding and general disconnect between pre-hospital and hospital providers. I hope this episode reminds us that our pre-hospital crews are working in very limited environments. Mike talked about using restraints and benzos for agitated and violent patients, which my previous guests on this podcast, who, might I add, work in the, quote, cruise ship conditions of a hospital, have advocated strongly against. I have to put myself in the shoes of paramedics in this confined space of an ambulance with a client swinging at them. At the hospital, we can call for extra staff, security, physician consults, social workers, but paramedics can't. I can definitely appreciate the inclination to use physical and or pharmacologic restraints in these scenarios. Along the same vein, pre-hospital crews are not frequently made aware of the downstream effects of what happens to their client after they are dropped off at the hospital. I'm thinking about the negative effects from physical restraints in the setting of acute agitation, such as rhabdomyolysis, metabolic acidosis, or cardiac dysrhythmias. I'm thinking about paradoxical effects from benzos, such as acute delirium. Or, even more mundane, consider the patient's volume status, as the patient may have received IV fluids en route. Ultimately, what I hope nurses can take away from this episode is that what is done and given to a patient in an ambulance may not necessarily be reflected in the patient's chart. You may not be able to see that your patient was restrained just a few hours ago, or the 500cc NS bolus they received in the ambulance probably won't show up in the MAR. I encourage all nurses to consider pre-hospital interventions for all of your patients who are brought in by ambulance. If you found value in this podcast, please share it with your fellow nursing friends and colleagues. It really helps me to grow the show and to keep producing these high-value episodes for you. If you would like more practice-improving content in between episodes, follow me on Instagram or Facebook at UpMyNursingGame. All right, that's all for today. Keep sharing this podcast with your nursing friends and colleagues. It would really mean the world to me. Claim your free CE credit, and until next time, I hope that you have upped your nursing game.